Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 16th, 2009. I'm Robert Rederich. This week, setting a scientifically responsible agenda for personalized medicine, forming stars more than 20 times more massive than our sun, and how the culture and practice of astronomy is changing. All this and more, plus a roundup of the latest science stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
It was 2006 when Democratic Senator Barack Obama introduced the Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act. It went nowhere. In 2007, he tried again, co-sponsoring it with Republican Senator Richard Burr. But the second version was a bit different from the first. It made omissions that avoided addressing questions of race and ethnicity in the pursuit of personalized medicine. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Sandra Sujin Lee and Ashwin Madaliar argue for legislators to put that text about race and ethnicity back into legislation that's currently being considered, and so push academic and industry scientists to set a scientifically valid agenda for genomics and personalized medicine. I spoke with Lee from her office at Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics in California.
The Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act is an ambitious piece of legislation that's really trying to create, if you will, the next pharmacogenomic highway. And we were interested in understanding why the original measures around dealing with issues of race and ethnicity were dropped in the 2007 version that's now being considered by the Senate, particularly since human genetic variation is such a critical area of concern for the development of pharmacogenomics.
Before we get to the legislation itself, how are the categories of race and ethnicity currently being used in research and industry?
Well, that is a very interesting question because really there is a lot of variation in terms of the categories and how they're defined. The federal agencies like the NIH and the FDA require that scientists identify their participants according to the OMB categories, which are the census categories. However, there's been a lot of debate over whether or not that's really an appropriate way to go about some of this research, particularly since the OMB itself has said that these categories are socially and historically constructed and that they really weren't meant to be used as scientific variables. And that is part of the reason why we wrote this piece, is because it looked like there would have been a measure that would have encouraged conversation about how we should be defining these categories, and yet that was taken out of the legislation.
So the legislation itself would have spurred conversations about how scientists or scientific thinking should consider race and ethnicity.
That's right. So there was a large section devoted to race, genomics, and health where these various agencies would be required to determine whether or not these were really appropriate definitions in terms of categories of race and ethnicity and to really think about what impact they might have on pharmacogenomic development.
What does current scientific thinking now say about these two categories? Should they be or should they not?
Well, there's a lot of controversy, and I think some scientists believe that really race and ethnicity do not belong in human genetic variation research and that they don't map, that the variation that we see, genetic variation that is, doesn't map neatly onto our categories. Others have suggested that, no, we do need these categories as a way of capturing some of the difference. And so because there is a lack of agreement, there really does need, I think, some leadership on the part of these different institutions to come to some guidance for the scientific community.
Now to the legislation, you mentioned there was a bill that did consider and was going to prompt these discussions about race and ethnicity and using it in a scientifically valid way. When was that bill introduced and what happened to it?
Well, this was S-1576, which is an overarching Minority Health Improvement and Health Disparity Elimination Act. That's still being considered, and yes, some of these measures were put into that piece of legislation. However, there's some key omissions, and one is the mandate that was in the original bill, the original Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act of 2006, that would require scientists to really, or encourage them, to make sure that they had enough representation of individuals from minority populations to do subgroup analysis. So, as you may be aware, that most of the materials that we have out there, DNA samples, are actually from majority populations, European American populations, and oftentimes it's very difficult to try to recruit minority populations into this type of research. This act had a measure that would try to encourage that type of representation into the research. So that was dropped. Some of the other measures that would help think about some of the issues around racial and ethnic categories were included. However, the argument that Ashwin Mudaliar and I have made is that because the Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act is really trying to do a major overhaul in pharmacogenomics, in particular create a national DNA biobank, it would be very important to address these issues in the context of the bill that's trying to create some of these large-scale initiatives.
So in your view, the legislators ought to go back to the text from the 2006 Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act, S-3822, first introduced by then-Senator Barack Obama, and use that language in future considerations of a Genomics and Personalized Medicine Act. Is that right?
Yes, I do. I think it's a missed opportunity to provide some clarity and some leadership on some of these issues around human genetic variation. And because it is such an ambitious piece of legislation, really trying to not only encourage benchside work on pharmacogenomics, but really translate it to the clinical setting, it would be very important to deal with some of the difficulties around defining difference, population differences vis-a-vis some of these categories. And so I think it would be a great opportunity to create some leadership among our federal institutions.
But for now, the pharmaceutical industry is sort of left on its own without that leadership?
Well, it's gotten mixed messages, I think. I mean, I think we can look back to the case of Bidil, which is the first medication that has been approved by the FDA for a racially identified population, in this case African Americans, and it approved that in 2005. And in doing so, it really put us in a difficult position in terms of scientists trying to define race and ethnicity. You know, some of the long-term implications of some of the categories that we use is how they are going to stand up outside of our borders, for example. So what does it mean to be an African American in the United States versus a black elsewhere? It really, the FDA, by creating a label specifically for a racially identified population, has complicated, I think, some of the issues that the act was trying to clarify, at least in its original version. So President-elect Obama has recently emphasized his support for this act and has obviously a deep interest in the development of genomics, genomic medicine. And I think this act is perhaps a first step towards trying to reap some of the investments that we've made, the public has made, into genomic research. However, I think that if we went back to including some of the measures around thinking about race and ethnicity as the original bill had laid out for us, it would really address some of the scientific and ethical issues that are so important for the development of personalized medicine.
Well, Sandra Sujin Lee, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Robert.
Sandra Sujin Lee is lead author of a policy forum on the Genetics and Personalized Medicine Act. Read all about it in this week's Science. A report by a Congress-appointed committee garnered headlines last month because of its description that a major terrorist attack was likely in the United States within the next 5 years. Here with more about it and some related government actions this week is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
The report was issued by the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism, which Congress established as a follow-on to the 9/11 Commission. The report considers nuclear terrorism a serious threat, but it lists biological terrorism as the more immediate concern because of the greater availability of harmful pathogens and the lower technological barriers. The report states that the government must work to provide better oversight of labs that work with the most dangerous biological agents. The commission believes that the government's approach to bioterrorism has placed too little emphasis on prevention. The U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a recent hearing on the report. Although the focus was on domestic high containment labs at the hearing, one recommendation was that the State Department convene a biotech power conference to discuss international norms and codes of conduct when it comes to security and safety. Senator Joe Lieberman, who chairs the committee, said the report and its recommendations would be a focal point of the committee's work this year. The House Armed Services Committee will be having a hearing on the report on January 22nd. On January 12th, President Bush issued a related executive order. It establishes a high-level interagency working group to examine ways to oversee security at biocontainment labs.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Stars get bigger through gravitationally attracting gas and dust, a process called accretion. But scientists calculate that a star about 20 times larger than our sun would put out so much light, and hence radiation pressure, that it would actually push gas and dust away from the star. That's presented scientists with a long-standing mystery because astronomers regularly observe stars that are much more than 20 times bigger than our sun, and even see stars 100 times bigger than our sun. In a paper published online by Science, Mark Krumholtz and colleagues propose a three-dimensional simulation that may have solved this mystery. I spoke with him from his office at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Massive stars are important because even though they're very rare, they are the most luminous type of star. And when you do the accounting, they're the stars that wind up putting out most of the power in the universe. They're essentially the only type of star we can see in very distant galaxies. So if you want to understand the bulk of the energy in the universe and where it's coming from, you need to understand how massive stars form. The problem is that it's very hard to see how a massive star could form. And the reason is that because they're so bright, the radiation they put out makes it very hard for gas to fall onto them. If you look at a massive star and you say, suppose I have a massive star that's in the process of forming, and there's some blob of gas around it which is supposed to accrete onto the star and increase its mass, and that's how the star forms. Well, gravity is trying to pull that gas inward, but the star is very bright, and the radiation it puts out exerts a force, and that force is opposite in direction from gravity.
So is that what's meant by radiation pressure, and is that what your team's simulation took into account?
Exactly. So, yeah, so this radiation force is the radiation pressure force. And its radiation pressure is just the force exerted by light on any object or surface that it strikes. And we're not used to thinking about it because under terrestrial conditions, it's completely tiny. It can only be measured with specialized apparatus. But when you get to these extremely bright stars, it can be an incredibly large force. And it turns out, if you just sort of go through the arithmetic, that the radiation force you expect to be stronger than gravity for the most massive stars. So you would naively think, well, all right, once radiation is stronger than gravity, the star should stop growing. And the problem is, if you ask when does radiation become stronger than gravity, it turns out to be at a limit of around 20 solar masses. The difficulty is that we observe stars that are 80 solar masses, 100. And so how do such things form? So that's the basic problem.
So in your team simulation, the radiation pressure didn't stop the stars from growing? Is that right?
Exactly.
Why not?
So the answer is that the world is more complicated than one dimension. The world has three dimensions. And when the radiation tries to stop the star from growing, it's subject to a phenomenon we discovered that's very similar to one called Rayleigh-Taylor instability. So Rayleigh-Taylor instability is easy to understand, and it's one that's very familiar from everyday life. It's the reason that you can have oil floating on water, but you can't have water floating on oil. If you try to have water floating on oil, well, the water is denser. So what you'll find is that even if you've got a nice layer of water on top of the oil, any disturbance at the interface between the two, even a microscopic one, will be amplified. If there's a little divot where the water goes down a little further, well, more water will flow into that divot, which will go push down further into the oil and so forth, and similarly the oil wants to go up. And what you'll wind up with is the water will sink to the bottom and the oil to the top. it turns out that when we did this three-dimensional simulation, we found something very similar happening with radiation and gas. That is, the gas is heavy, gravity wants to pull it in, and it wants to fall onto the star. And the radiation is trying to escape, move away from the star. And so what we found is that rather than the radiation and the gas stopping one another, rather than the radiation sort of dragging the gas away, instead the radiation and the gas managed to avoid one another. Any little place where the gas made a little divot, where it got a little closer to the star, well, more gas would flow down that divot, more gas would go into it, and the radiation would go around it. And so the net result was that even though on average the radiation had more than enough force to blow away the gas, there were always channels of gas falling onto the star and radiation which avoided those channels or went around them. That's the basic finding of the simulation.
So at the very end of the simulation, what was left?
Well, we stopped the simulation at the point when we'd accreted 70% of the initial cloud that we started with onto the stars. And that was sort of an arbitrary stopping point. We could have continued it, and the stars were still continuing to gain mass, but we stopped it because nothing else very interesting was happening and because our computer budget is finite and our patience is finite, and these simulations take a long time and a lot of supercomputer time to run. So what we were left with was two stars, in fact, a binary system consisting of a 40-solar mass star and a 30-solar mass star in orbit around each other.
Each being larger than the 20-mass.
Exactly. Each larger than that 20-solar mass limit. And then an envelope around them still had 30-solar masses of gas in it, which was continuing to accrete onto the stars.
If you ran the simulation again, would the same thing happen?
Almost certainly. The reason that a companion star forms is because the disk that is feeding the first star we form becomes gravitationally unstable. And that's simply because mass is falling onto it faster than it can process that mass and dump it onto the star in the center. So mass winds up building up in this disk, and it can't get rid of it fast enough. And the way it solves this problem is that the disk fragments. It forms a second lump in addition to the first. And that's what happened in our simulation, and that's what we would expect to happen under any simulation using similar initial conditions. And so this is a very nice natural explanation of why it is that every massive star has a massive star companion. That is, massive stars always come in pairs. It's not something we put into the simulation. It's something that just happened naturally.
Is it likely, given your team's model, if you'd allowed it to keep running, that planets might have formed too?
Well, I don't know about planets. The reason I am dubious about planets is that we know from observations that low-mass stars have disks that persist a long time. High-mass stars do not. The higher the mass of a star, the rarer and rarer a disk becomes. And so what we think is going on is that around these very massive stars, around a 40-solar mass star, the disk is extremely short-lived. And essentially, as soon as accretion slows down, the star destroys it. And in that case, there probably wouldn't be time for planets to form.
What would further improve your team's model? Is there anything that could...
Yes, there are definitely things that could be improved and that we are in the process of trying to improve. One is that we did the simulation with initial conditions where we left out the fact that these blobs of gas are extremely turbulent. And we did that so we could isolate the physics of how the radiation interacts with gravity and the infalling gas. But in real life, these cores are turbulent, and we should do simulations that include that effect and see how the picture changes. A second thing that we should be including, which we're working on now and isn't in this model, is protostellar outflows. And that is when the disk gets very, very close to the star, a magnetic field that is threading the gas is wound up, and this causes the star to launch a jet of material above and below the disk. And we see these jets coming from all young stars. In our simulation, we just left that out, and it should be included in the next generation of simulations. That's sort of the immediate future. The more distant future is doing simulations where we start on larger scales and form not a single star or a single binary system, but an entire cluster of stars. And that would be very nice to do, but the limiting factor is computer time and the amount of time it takes to run these simulations.
Well, Mark Krumholz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Krumholz is lead author of a paper on the formation of massive star systems by accretion. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Four 400 years ago, Galileo first began peering through his telescope, chronicling in his book, Starry Messenger, the story of the invention and what he saw, which included 4 moons of Jupiter seen for the very first time. Since then, the culture and practice of astronomy has, of course, changed, but there is still work to be done in the field by amateur astronomers, who still occasionally make discoveries. In this week's Science, Adrian Cho and Dan Cleary write about the changes in the culture and practice of astronomy, from the very big and expensive projects like the Hubble Telescope to the discoveries made by a primary school teacher in the Netherlands. I spoke with Cho from France, together with Cleary in England. Here's Adrian Cho.
400 years after the invention of the telescope, astronomy is flourishing. In the last couple of decades, researchers have made discoveries that are opening new horizons. But even as the science flourishes, the field is evolving very quickly. Astronomy is already big science, but it's becoming much bigger in a hurry. And we've identified several trends along these lines. The first being that there's an increase in the number of really large surveys that astronomers are doing. These are operations that, instead of looking for individual objects in the skies, try to capture everything in some huge swath of the sky. At the same time, there's a push towards much bigger telescopes. Of course, all of this also means that these projects are much more expensive. They take longer to build. So astronomy is running into some of the problems that other big sciences have with increasing budget tensions and much more international collaborations.
In addition to what Adrian was saying,
Dan Cleary,
astronomers are trying to answer very complicated astrophysical and cosmological questions. So to do that, they're going to different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that they didn't have access to before. Originally, they just had optical telescopes, but then they wanted more information, so they, you know, started looking to radio waves and microwaves, and as soon as they had satellites, they could look at X-rays and things that were blocked by the atmosphere. And most recently, they've had gamma ray astronomy. So there are all these other sources of information that are making astronomy a much more diverse group of researchers than they once were.
So we're not limited then by astronomers having to climb up the mountaintop, as it were. They can just get their data from the internet. Adrian?
That's how the big surveys work. And the prototype of this sort of work is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is run using a 2.5-meter telescope at Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico. And the Sloan Survey is cataloging everything that that telescope can see in one quarter of the celestial sphere. And this includes 100 million galaxies. And Sloan works in a novel way, whereas traditionally astronomers share a telescope and different teams will apply for observing time to look at different objects. The Sloan team, all 150 of them, work together to harvest all this data, which is then put in a gigantic computer database. After the fact, small teams and individuals can go through the data, which is eventually made publicly available, but the collecting of it is all done together. It is one big project.
Is it just visual telescopes that are putting their images out for everyone to see, Dan?
No, I think, you know, there is a growth in sort of astronomical databases in all the different wavelengths, but some are very much in their infancy still. You know, gamma ray astronomy only really has a number of prototype telescopes. They're looking at very high energy events in deep space, such as supernovas and gamma ray bursts, you know, really violent explosions that involve a lot of energy that accelerate particles so that you get these high energy gamma rays, the high energy universe.
Well, more projects, more questions for astronomers to address, more people working together to try to answer these questions. It seems like a very good problem for astronomers to have.
It is, and I think they relish having these big problems. And, you know, with big problems, they always, you know, the standard response is they need a bigger telescope. And today, they have telescopes that are 10 meters across. The mirror is 10 meters across. But now astronomers are planning a big jump from that to telescopes that are 30, 40, even more meters across than that. So these are huge, huge instruments, which would be a real engineering challenge and cost billions of dollars to construct. And because they're so big and so expensive, they would change the way astronomers worked. You know, in the past, an astronomer, an individual astronomer, or say a small group, would go up to the telescope on the mountainside, and they would have their block of time, and they would, you know, steer the scope and look at what they want to look at and gather their data and go home again. But with something that big and that expensive, it would have to be computer controlled, because you wouldn't want to waste any spare time, you know, just finding your object or steering the telescope. It would want to be done, you know, automatically and very fast, so that the maximum amount of time pointing at the stars was made available to astronomers. So probably most of the astronomers that used such a telescope would never get to go and see it. They just get the data sent to them at their desks.
Does that mean that astronomy is becoming a big science like high energy physics, say? Adrian?
Well, in some ways it is, and in some ways it's not. Astronomers are quick to point out that astronomy continues to enjoy a wonderful diversity, both in the subject matter and in the size of the teams that are able to contribute to the field. That said, even the smaller teams are getting bigger as people pool their resources and their expertise, and the push is generally towards bigger instruments and bigger teams. And so at the same time, even though astronomy remains much more diverse than, say, high-energy physics, it's starting to experience some of the same problems that high-energy physics has run into. For example, as the size of projects gets bigger, the size of national astronomy budgets hasn't kept pace, and that means that competition for funding dollars is becoming much more intense.
So, Dan, does that mean that there aren't any projects that these governments that are funding astronomy see as must-do projects?
I don't know if governments see any of them as must-do, but astronomers have high priorities, and the governments want to, you know, support astronomy, so they ask astronomers what they would like to do most. But whether the governments can afford to do what astronomers want, you know, they don't always match. The European astronomers just recently published a wish list of their most important projects over the next 10 or 20 years. And one of those was one of these, you know, extremely large telescopes. And they're waiting to hear from the European governments whether they're going to get the money to do it.
To add to what Dan was saying, in the United States, even now, the current wish list that astronomers put together 8 years ago, the so-called decadal survey, many of the projects on that have not been funded to construction, and all of the major ground-based projects in that survey have yet to be completed. So the competition for resources is becoming quite intense, largely because the size of the projects is getting so big.
What's the future hold, then, for the culture of astronomy? Adrian?
Well, as I see it, astronomy continues to flourish. The number of astronomers is growing, and I don't imagine that that will actually change. I think that astronomy is quite healthy and will continue to grow. I think, however, that there is perhaps the beginning of a parting of ways. Astronomy is special in that we can all view the sky, and many people can afford to buy a small telescope and view the sky themselves. And amateur astronomy remains vital, and occasionally amateur astronomers make bona fide discoveries. That said, professional astronomy is becoming more centered around very large instruments, computerized data streams, data that's not necessarily even viewed by human eyes. And I think that there is perhaps the beginning of a parting of ways where this act of peering up into the night sky through your own telescope is starting to bear less resemblance to what professional astronomers do on a day-to-day basis. It's still about viewing the sky and looking for the gems in the sky. But the actual practice of astronomy is looking much more professional and much more remote than it did, say, 50 years ago.
Well, Dan Cleary and Adrian Cho, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob. You.
Science's Adrian Cho and Dan Cleary write about the change in the culture and practice of astronomy. Read their article and the whole News Focus section commemorating the International Year of Astronomy, 2009, in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how you can tell if you're a money maker by looking at your hands, how caffeine might be linked to hallucinations, and finally, how future astronauts may survive by eating silkworms.
Well, I'm looking at my hands. How do I tell if I'm a moneymaker? Let's start with that story.
Well, Rob, look at your ring finger. Now, if it's bigger than your index finger,
it is,
and mine is too, it means that you are exposed to more testosterone in the womb than people who have the opposite finger ratio. And what this does is this extra amount of testosterone sensitizes you as an adult to testosterone. And what that in turn does, studies have shown, is it makes you more willing to take risks, and it tends to give you quicker reactions.
Both important things for financial traders.
Exactly. You can think of a financial trader on the trading floor. And obviously, these people have to be able to make split-second decisions. There's a lot of activity going on the floor. And a lot of their job involves dealing with big risks.
And some research suggests that people who had bigger ring fingers than index fingers made more money than those who didn't.
Exactly. What researchers did in this new study was they actually took handprints of 44 day traders on a fast-paced London trading floor, and they examined their ring finger to index finger ratio. And this was all men. And what they found was that traders that had a longer ring finger than their index finger made a lot more money than traders who had the opposite ratio. In fact, over a 20-month period, the traders with the larger ring fingers made an average of $1.2 million, which was six times more than traders who had larger index fingers than ring fingers.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Now, you said this didn't apply to women.
Well, they only studied men.
And they only studied men that were in a fast-paced trading environment.
Exactly. And there's a lot of other traders besides just these traders that work on these fast-paced trading floors. In fact, you've got people that tend to do much more long-term investments. And the authors of the study say that it's possible that these people who do longer-term investments may utilize a different skill set.
How is this research being received?
Well, one of the experts that the writer of this article spoke to called the research fascinating, and he says he's really interested in this idea of looking at financial trading not as this sort of idea of what's rational and people making rational decisions, but rather in the sphere of natural selection. What is it about our bodies or our physiology that may make us more prone to making money than other people?
I imagine there'd be a whole host of ethical issues if you pursued that line of thinking too long.
It seems like it certainly could be a problem.
Well, from the physiology of what makes for a good day trader to the physiology behind hallucinations. Caffeine? Really? I'm having some coffee right now.
Well, if you believe this article, if you're drinking a lot of coffee, you may be more prone to hallucinations than the average person.
How so?
Well, the basis of this study is a steroid hormone our body produces known as cortisol. And other studies have shown that when we're stressed out, our body tends to produce a lot of cortisol. And cortisol can cause people to see and hear things that aren't there. Now, the link to caffeine is other studies have shown that caffeine can increase our response to stress and therefore also have an effect on this cortisol pathway.
So researchers were looking for experimental evidence to validate this connection.
Exactly. And what this team did was they created an online survey. And this survey had about 200 questions, and it asked things like, how many cups of coffee do you drink a day, and how strong is the coffee that you drink? But it also asked respondents to rate the trueness of statements like, sometimes I feel like I'm talking to people who aren't there, or sometimes I feel like I've left my body temporarily. And that was obviously to gauge whether these people were having hallucinations. And what they found was that people who tended to consume more caffeine during the day, whether it was in the form of tea or coffee or even chocolate, were more likely to hallucinate.
Any confounding factors here?
Well, the big confounding factor here is, although this shows an association between consuming caffeine and having hallucinations, it doesn't show that caffeine actually causes hallucinations. In other words, somebody who's prone to hallucinations may also just be prone to drinking a lot of coffee. So the study isn't rigorous enough to prove the link. It just shows that there's an association.
What about building up a tolerance? I think I've got a pretty good tolerance now to caffeine because of the coffee I drink.
Well, that's the other problem. People tend to build up a tolerance to caffeine, as you say. They may also build up a tolerance to hallucinations, which you would think would weaken this effect if caffeine was actually causing the hallucinations in the first place. So that's another confounding factor.
Huh, a tolerance to hallucinations. I must be hallucinating myself right now. Maybe it's the caffeine, but I thought you had said something about astronauts eating silkworms.
I did indeed. You were not hallucinating, Rob. This story, this final story, is about future space missions. And the problem with future space missions is that they're envisioned to take months or even years as we explore areas of space and planets that are farther and farther away from Earth. And the question is, how are astronauts going to survive on these missions? What are they going to eat? And researchers have been thinking about this question for a long time, and they've considered various food sources. Obviously, we need a lot of protein in our diet to survive. And a lot of our protein now, for those of us who aren't vegetarians, comes from things like chicken and fish.
Those would be pretty hard to bring on a spacecraft, wouldn't it?
That's true. Especially with poultry, you're talking about relatively large creatures that take up a lot of space, produce a lot of excrement. And even with fish, you've got the problem of fish need to be grown in a very controlled environment. Otherwise, they don't mate like they're supposed to. They don't grow like they're supposed to. So there's problems with these two food sources. And so a group of scientists proposed silkworms.
To eat.
To eat.
Why silkworms? Lots of protein?
Well, that's one thing. Silkworm pupae are mostly protein. And in fact, they contain twice as many essential amino acids as pork does, and four times as much as eggs and milk. But that's not the only thing. They're also very small, so they don't take up a lot of space. They breed very quickly, and they only produce small amounts of excrement, which itself can be used as a fertilizer.
Now, wait, you'd still have to eat a lot of them, right?
You would. In fact, the researchers on this paper estimate you'd have to eat about 170 of them a day.
Doesn't that still sort of cramp the spaceship?
Well, a lot less than chicken or fish would. And what's a real bonus is that even the inedible parts of the silkworms, such as their silk, can actually be made edible through chemical processing, and it could be mixed with fruit juice, sugar, and even food coloring to make jam. And Rob, you know, this idea is really not so far-fetched. There's already people in China that eat silkworms. So for Chinese astronauts, at least, this would be a natural. And for other astronauts, it would just be a question of overcoming some cultural taboos.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, in Science Now, we're looking into a story about the neurological basis for why some people follow the crowd more than others do, and also a story about why the bat did not cross the road. And on Science Insider, we continue to follow updates about Obama's transition to the White House. And specifically this week, we're looking a lot into math and science education. What do Obama's picks portend for how math and science are taught in the classroom? So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog. Find a link online at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the January 16th, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.